And I'm delighted to welcome a lady who's come a considerable number of miles along with her husband to tell us her stirring story, which she's written. It's a long book, and I think there's a promise of more to come, over 400 pages in Helga, by Helga Jahadin. I believe I've pronounced that correctly, Helga, haven't I?
Not quite.
Go on.
Jahadi.
I remember Keir Hardy, but I couldn't get round to Jahadi. And that's a Swiss name, isn't it?
No, it's not a Swiss name, because you mustn't forget I was Swiss before I married.
Exactly, yes.
And, of course, getting married, you know, I became British, although I could keep my Swiss nationality, and I still have got it. I never lost it, actually. And I'm glad I haven't, because I think it's important to keep what you've got.
Exactly, yes. We're very proud of our traditions and heritage here in Norfolk, and I'm sure that's the same the world over, isn't it?
Yes.
Where have you come to from today to see us?
From Aylesbury in Buckinghamshire.
So that's a fair way, as I said, on your
yes.
bike, is it?
No, I didn't come on my bike. No. Although I've got it in the story that I did a long journey on my bike, but no, this time I didn't. My husband brought me by car.
Yours is a stirring story, as I said, set in before the war, the Hitler's rise, and what you had to do as a result of all that. Why has it taken you till now to write the story, Helga?
When I was a refugee during the war, or just at the end of the war, I had a rather terrible time, something similar to what people experience now in Bosnia and Serbia, and I could never talk about it. I never did. I would talk about when I went to school and what it was like under Hitler and so on, but I would never talk about the time when I was a refugee. And it was my children who one day said to me, you really ought to put it down onto paper, and even if we don't read it, you know, we have got at least a record of it. So I started to write, and I think once I started to write, it sort of started to flow. It absolutely flowed out, and it all came out, and then I was able to talk about it. And of course, when they read it, they felt it was so tremendously important that everybody ought to know about it, that it ought to be published. And this is what had happened. I've got a book now, and it's called after my name, Helga.
It's difficult for those of us who, A, weren't born at that time, or certainly had nothing to do with that part of the world at that time, to appreciate what it was like as Hitler came to power and all the manifestations of that, Nazism, etc. Do you still look back and shudder, and do you feel cold when you recall the way it was done? Because there wasn't much people could do about it, was there?
No. Everything was kept very quiet in any case. I don't think we knew an awful lot about it, because I lived in Königsberg, the capital of East Prussia, and we had no concentration camps near us. The only thing I remember is that we had two girls at school in my class who were Jewish, and they just disappeared. And I tried to find out what happened to one of them, because I was rather friendly. And I went to have a look at her house, and they had a draper's shop, which was smashed in. And I'm afraid the flat upstairs was empty and the windows were broken. And when I very gently inquired what had happened to Eva, people sort of said, look, don't ask questions, that was the SS, you know, and you better go home and disappear. I was only a child. It was better not to talk about it. And my father always pointed out to us, we were four children, he always pointed out, you are guests in this country. You see, we were Swiss, and he said, keep quiet, you know, you're guests in this country. But I think he himself knew quite a bit, but didn't want us to know about it, because we might talk, and that was dangerous.
You were excused certain things, like the Hitler signal, weren't you, because of you being Swiss?
Yes.
Sit at the back and quietly say the words, but don't
That's
do the
right.
signal.
Yes, yeah. I didn't have to say Heil Hitler, but it was a common greeting. I don't think people even thought about Hitler when they said it. It was, instead of saying good morning, you just said Heil Hitler, and that was acknowledged everywhere, but my father didn't like me to do it, so I sat in the back of the class, and I used to, when the teacher entered the class, she used to stand in front and say Heil Hitler, and then the whole class get up and they all say Heil Hitler. I would just only stand up and sit down. The trouble was, when we had a new teacher, he used to point out, sort of look and say, you didn't say Heil Hitler. And then all the girls used to shout, well, of course she can't say Heil Hitler, because she isn't German, she is Swiss. And it became a little bit embarrassing at times. I didn't want to be different. As a child, you don't want to be different in a class.
But you sorted that teacher out, didn't you?
Well, there was one, yes. There was one teacher. He was a very big Nazi, actually. And I think he knew that he would get a better position if he sort of brought it home to everybody about how good Hitler was and so on. And yes, when it came to his examination time, I'm afraid I did a little stint on him, which... Well, yes, I don't think he passed in the end, and my headmaster, although he called me to come to his study, and he didn't really tell me off because he was an officer from the First World War and I don't think he was a Nazi, but of course he couldn't say anything.
You accidentally sort of muddled the props up.
Yes, I did, like actually. That, yes, yes. Instead of bringing the right maps, I brought the wrong maps, and when he sort of stood in front of the class and he said, you know, this is the map of the Napoleonic War, and he unfolded it, of course it wasn't, you see, so yes, I did a joke.
He shouldn't have messed with you, should he? You're very strong-willed and a bit of a tomboy, weren't you,
yes,
when you were a young mother?
Yes. I think that really made me sort of stand up for things. But I was very popular at school. The girls all liked me, and they did like to get the teachers into trouble, like children do at times. And I was like that.
But you were very good. You joined in all the boys' games. I believe you went in goal.
Oh, yes, I played football. I was pretty tough. Was pretty tough, which was very good, because then when towards the end of the war, when I was a refugee, I think if I hadn't been so strong and tough, I wouldn't have survived.
That certainly comes out in the early chapters. It acted as a kind of preparation for the difficulties to come. So in sort of brief sort of way, you tell us what did happen to your family?
Well, when the Russians eventually entered East Prussia, we were never told what happened on the radio, because we were only allowed to listen to one station, which was the local one, and of course we were always told, oh, the German army is holding the Russians back. But because I was a medical student and I worked at the local military hospital, we got the wounded soldiers coming back from the front, and they informed us that the Russians were pretty close. Well, my family was very scattered, because everybody seemed to be somewhere else, when I suddenly realized, if I don't leave now, I will never get out, because the Russians were gradually encircling the town. So I just packed my bag and just started off with a refugee track. The trouble was, it was in the winter 1945, and it was very, very cold. We had 10 and 15 degrees below zero. So when you start walking in snow and ice and you haven't got any shelter, it's not very comfortable, and it's very, very cold, and you have no food. After a time, you run out of food. So you try and get something from the other people from the tracks, but they won't give it to you, because if they're part with their food, then they haven't got any for themselves. So you steal, and I did. And if you've got nothing to eat, you try and eat the bark of the tree, which I did. But I think the cold was the worst. The hunger you forget after a time. You get used to it. You just sort of stumble along. But it is the cold. You really, even today, I can't be cold. That's the one thing I can't bear, to be cold. And it took me about 6 weeks to flee in front of the Russians. They used to shoot at us. We had to cross the ice. It's a part called the Huff, which is a division between the Baltic and the mainland, and you have a small strip which is called the Nerung, and if we knew if we reached that, we could get away from the Russians, because otherwise, like I said, they encircled us. Well, they knew we were refugees, but they still shot at us, and if the ice breaks, horses and carts just disappear, and it's no good trying to help them, because you knew even if you got them out, first of all, you might break in yourself, but even if you got them out, they would be dead, because 15 degrees below zero, I mean, you don't survive that. But we made it to the other side, and like I said, there were only trees along the small bit of land in Nerung, where we tried to eat the bark. But I made it eventually to Greifswald. In the end, I got a lift on a train, but only because I jumped onto the buffers in the back. Otherwise, I wouldn't have got it. And when I got to Greifswald, I'm afraid I collapsed and finished up in hospital. I was in such a bad state. They had to burn my clothes and cut my hair because it was so matted. And I nearly died. But no, I did survive, and I found my mother, because we had friends in the town, and this is why I made my way up there, still on the Baltic, Greifswald. I didn't like to stay there because I was still afraid that the Russians would come. We were always afraid of the Russians. When I think of the time, of that time, nobody was afraid in the West, because they all knew if the English and Americans came, that would be the end, and the Germans wanted to finish the war. It were only the politicians who didn't. And they knew they would be treated all right by the Allied armies. But we in the East, we knew what the Russians were like. We had been told by the soldiers who had reconquered certain villages what they did. And in my book, I have written a little bit about it. I described, there's a chapter called The Village of Hell. I haven't told everything, and that was hard enough to tell, but it is true, and I felt that people ought to know what happened there.
How did you recall all these incidents? Did you have a diary?
I had a diary, but of course I didn't write it when I was a refugee because I couldn't write then, but I did write it afterwards. I made notes. It's the names you forget, but the incidents and the happenings, you never forget. Oh, you never forget. You can't. You know, even now I feel cold thinking of it. You never forget those, what happened to you.
Should we be allowed to forget? We have a lot of anniversaries coming up, don't we? We have the film Schindler's List. We have so many very strong reminders of what happened. Do you think it's right that it should be kept in front of us for the time being anyhow?
Yes, I think you ought to, because look at Bosnia and Serbia now. I think people shouldn't forget. People should know about it and read about it and know more and more, and maybe that will help to keep the peace, because it's not the soldiers only that suffer. It's also the civilian population that gets involved in war, and people don't treat you very well when you are a civilian, and when you're on the road you've got no shelter, you've got nobody to protect you.
What good do you think it's done you to pour yourself out into this book? And as I've already hinted, there's probably more to come, another volume perhaps.
I can talk about it now. I can mention it now. I don't mind talking about it. Well, some things I think I will still not talk, but most of it I can. So it has helped me, and I think it helped a lot of people reading it, because I've had fan mail, and people saying it in their letters. I had one from a person who has had similar experiences like I did, and she said when she came to England she tried to tell people about it and they didn't believe her, and she said, I'm so glad you wrote this book, because now I tell my friends, go and buy that book, there is a true story the same as mine, and read about it. I never lied, I spoke the truth.
Is this the first writing you've done?
I've done small stories, I was also a teacher, so I used to write stories for the children. But I've never written a book. No, this is the first full-size book I've written.
Is there a follow-up?
Well, actually, it was already a double-sized book. It was 800 pages, and I've had it edited, and Hilary Johnson had to cut it down because she said it will never be published being as big as that. So I have got a good bit to for the second book already, because I finish it where I left Germany to go back to Switzerland. And people ask me, well, now how did you come to England in the end and got married and wrote the book in English?
Well, you keep that under your hat, don't you?
Yes, because I have to.
They can find out in the second instalment.
Yes.
I believe this is available locally, because although you come down from Aylesbury to see us today, is it W.H. Smith's
and
Waterstones,
yes,
in Norwich have copies of,
yes,
it?
I'll, yes,
give full details,
right,
of the book. It's called Helga, the true story of a young woman's flight as a refugee and how she reunited her war-scattered family, by Helga Jihadi?
Jihadi.
I will insist on missing out the J. It's spelled with a G. E-R-H-A-R-D-I. That's Helga Jihadi. E-G-E-R-H-A-R-D-I. It's published by Verona at £6.99, which I think is a bargain for a book of 430 pages.
Yes, everybody says that.
with more to come. And I'm pleased you've been able to come see us today, Helga. And apart from the gripping instalment of this, I think people will be interested to know when the second one is on the way. Is there any indication given as to when part two might be on the bookshelves?
No.
But you let us know and we'll let them know.
Oh, I will.
That would be the best thing to do.
Yes.
But it is a gripping yarn, and it's one that I think a lot of people will be interested to read, particularly at this time when there is the rise of anti-Semitism again in parts of Europe, and there are all the anniversaries.
Yes, we've got D-Day coming up.
Exactly,
now,
we have that.
June.
And of course there is a big argument as to how that should be marked.
Yes.
You can remember these things, but not necessarily celebrate. I think that's the way a lot of people see it, isn't
it? I wouldn't want to celebrate. I would want to remember, because I've had lots of friends that got killed and I never saw again. Of course, I never saw my home again either, because it's still Russian today. Although eastern part of Germany...
You haven't been back to have a look, have you?
No, but I've had one school friend I met. She has been back, and she took a video of it, and I've seen that. And it looks just as if the war finished. Nothing has ever been done. It looks terrible.
On that sombre note, Helga, we thank you for joining us today, along with your husband. Wish you well with the book. I'm sure it'll be a success in these parts, as it has been in others, and we look forward to Volume 2. And as I say, we'll certainly alert your readers and fan club as to when it might be on the way. That's Helga Jehardy.
Yes.
I've got there in the end, didn't I? £6.99 from Verona, V-I-R-O-N-A, Verona Publishing. Helga, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.